This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll check in with Matt Deitchley from the Indiana Department of Transportation to find out the latest on the big I-65 Northwest Indiana expansion project that's underway from U.S. 30 south to State Road 2 and including the Kankakee River bridges as well. There was a recent public information hearing held in Crown Point to explain the project. We'll find out the latest on it. Another edition of Green Fleet Radio with Carl Lissick is coming up, as well as another edition of Lakeshore Focus with Keith Kirkpatrick coming up as well. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a major project underway here in Northwest Indiana to try to improve traffic flow at the very least and be able to add more traffic, if you can imagine that. Where is it? It's on I-65 here in Lake County. And the Indiana Department of Transportation is working with the contractors on this project. Let's bring in Matt Deitchley, who is with the NDOT LaPorte District, to tell us a little bit more about the project. And Matt, how are you today?
Good. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. For folks that are not familiar with it, tell us a little of the history of the problems that have developed over the years on I-65 and why there is a need to be able to make this expansion possible.
Sure. You know, obviously most folks who drive 65 frequently realize that, there's a whole lot of traffic on that roadway. And, you know, the goal of NDOT is to obviously maintain safety and mobility at all time. So, you know, it's been a desire to expand a lane as far as we can go on I-65 for quite some time now. And we're fortunate that this project is underway right now. So we're just beginning year two of the lane expansion project for I-65 between U.S. 30 and just south of State Road 2. So, you know, it's the length of that we were able to go on this project. We're always looking to do more at some point in the future. But I think it's going to be a real benefit to folks in the area from a congestion standpoint. And obviously, that always benefits safety as well.
From what NDOT has looked at over the years, how long has it been, I guess, sort of in the on the drawing board that something needed to be done about all the added traffic on I-65?
Sure, you know, it's been a desire, obviously, since obviously you can see the congestion on the roadway. So, you know, there's been many years where this has been a desire to find a solution to that and add some lanes out there. And so we're looking forward to the project and being complete at the end of this in the fall. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be something that's going to be really beneficial. But, yeah, obviously congestion, as I said, folks who drive on that area know there's a lot of traffic out there, and this is going to benefit that.
Well, take us through the process that NDOT goes through if they come up with an idea like this. And, you know, they obviously are going to try to do what they possibly can within the literal footprint of the road itself. They don't want to have to buy any more right-of-way if they don't have to. But, obviously, they make some adjustments. So what kind of, I guess, behind-the-scenes procedures does NDOT have to go through before they get to the point that they are able to announce the project?
Sure. Now, every project is different. There are surfacing projects, and there's added travel lane projects on lots of different roads. But a road of the caliber of I-65 is going to be substantially more challenging due to the traffic that's already on there during the actual construction of it. But also, acquiring land is the biggest challenge for a lot of expanded highways in lots of areas because you have to buy the land, and there's a lot that goes into that. There's also utility relocation. So it can be a very lengthy process to expand a highway. The fortunate side for I-65 in this area is we already had the width in the shoulder area for the project limits of this project. So there wasn't any right-of-way to buy, and that always expedites the project. But it's still a substantial cost to do a project like this. So, you know, the governor, obviously, this was something that he was definitely behind, and he was here for the groundbreaking on this last year. So, you know, it's definitely a priority in that respect for NDOT as well. So that was the benefit. The biggest benefit for this project is that, you know, all that width was still there in the shoulder area, and so it's just a matter of taking those shoulders and making them road ready. So it's a substantial project, but a little more less challenging than it would be typically for added traveling where you would have to buy property.
Do you think that was possible that maybe when they designed this section of I-65, and it was a long time ago, obviously, that maybe they just put that in, they might have to do some expansion someday, and they thought, well, we might as well get the right-of-way purchased and have all that ready. And in this case, they actually got things built, I guess, part of the way for the shoulders so they could have that extra expansion room.
Yeah, that's correct. Typically, when we do roadways, you know, we always are looking to the future. So if we expect a road to have added capacity needed, We will do that. I wasn't around when this road was built specifically with NDOT, so I don't know off the top of my head if that was the design, but I would not be surprised if that was the plan in place. There are very wide shoulders here, which isn't typical for a lot of roadways. So, you know, I would be pretty confident in saying that that was part of the planning, but it worked out very well.
Well, I was going to ask you if the situation is that I know this project basically ends just about at, I guess, State Road 2 or actually points south to the Kankakee River bridges, because that's all mm-hmm. part of the project too. I wonder if maybe over time, we know we've talked about this before, that, and you've mentioned too just now, that there's likely to be some future expansion in other places on I-65 to the south when they possibly can, but they may have to buy some extra land, I suppose, in some of these places when they go further down. And I wonder if the case was if you're talking with your colleagues further south down around Lafayette, because they did the major expansion of I-65 down around Lafayette and the West Lafayette exits there. I'm sure they probably had to buy some land to be able to make room for that work.
Sure, and that one I'm not aware of it outside of my district, but I do know, you know, we are still planning ahead with this project too. So, like we said, the project goes just south of State Road 2. So the Kankakee River Bridge there, we're also rehabbing the Kankakee River Bridge while we're down there. But while we're doing that, we're expanding that bridge. So the bridge needed to be rehabbed anyway. So we're adding that to part of the project. But while we're down there, we're making sure that bridge is wide enough so that down the road, when we are able to expand I-65 further south, then that bridge will already be ready to accommodate that. So, you know, the worst thing we want to do is rehab that bridge and have it not be the width proper for added travel lanes when that day comes that project would happen. So we're planning ahead in that way as well.
Now, when we're talking about the bridges over the Kankakee River, and you mentioned that they're going to have to be rebuilt, I suppose, are they going to try to accommodate for the fact that they're so low now, and we know there are problems on US 41 in the Kankakee River area, as we've seen with our recent flooding. If it's this way, they could get the bridges higher, so there might be less chance of having any problems on I-65. We've been lucky, I guess, we haven't any flooding problems there, but it could possibly happen, couldn't it?
Sure, you know, that's something that all of our engineers and the planning that goes into these projects, they do that ahead of time. So they look at, have we had any issues with high water there? Would those bridges need to be higher for any reason? I don't believe that's the case in these bridges situation. But, you know, that's all part of the process when we plan for a new road or a new highway or just resurfacing a roadway is what issues have we had out there and are we able to alleviate them? So that's all part of the planning process. Right.
We're talking with Matt Deitchley, who is with the LaPorte District of NDOT, about the ongoing work. They will be finished up here yet this year for the expansion of I-65 here in Northwest Indiana. If you will take us through the process right now, how things stand on, you mentioned in general how the project is going to work, stretching south from US 30 all the way down to the Kankakee River, basically. What's the process as far as the construction work that's underway? It's still in phases, is it not?
Correct. Yeah, so last year we did the first, it's a 2-year project. So last year we completed the first year, and now we're back, just now starting. And probably, I believe it's Monday is when we're expecting some added additional traffic patterns changing, and this week as well on the overnight hours. So right now we're gearing up to do the construction throughout the year. So what you're going to find is, especially during the overnight hours, they're going to be essentially staging for all the work that's going to happen this year. So there's going to be some changing traffic patterns. There's going to be some lane closures in the overnight hours, so they can get everything set up for when we have a complete change traffic pattern on certain areas where they're working, then that's prepared to do that. So we obviously do as much work as we can in the overnight hours to not have an impact to traffic, and also for the safety of both drivers and our workers. You know, the lower times where they have lower traffic volumes is when it's the safest to do that. And so we'll do as much as we can in those overnight hours. But the plan right now is through the entire project, all through the year, during daytime hours, there will be two lanes in each direction on I-65 throughout the length of the project. Now, there's always a chance where they would have an emergency, or there may be some very quick 15-minute issue where they would have to do, so let's say there was a bridge beam setting or something like that, but they would schedule those in the overnight hours. So there's always a chance that something would happen where we would have to change that plan. But as of right now, the plan is to do two lanes in each direction throughout the project. So this week we're going to be expecting lots of things to be popping up here from lane closures, not just on I-65, but also on US 231 and State Road 2, where they're going to be working on some of the bridges there too. So,
yeah, tell us if you will about how what kind of impact this is going to have on the roads that either intersect or either go over the I-65 path, because we know that there have been some improvements. Of course, we've had it at additional roadways with 109th Avenue just north of 231. That's obviously, I guess, kind of planned that way. So this way, if you have the work to do, then you don't have any interference with that road. But what does it have to do with the impact on US 231 itself?
Sure. So, there'll be lane closures there so they can do some resurfacing. So, like what we're going to be doing this year, they're going to be widening and resurfacing bridges over US 231 and State Road 2. There's a worked ditch that's in that area. So there's resurfacing, there's widening going on because they have to accommodate all those intersecting roads and the bridges over and under I-65. So yeah, 65 isn't the only area where we're going to see some work, and there could be some lane closures on those other areas. Last year we were able to resurface 93rd Avenue over I-65. We had some bridge work done on 113th Avenue over I-65. So, all these roads that intersect I-65 or have interchanges, there's some work going on above and below as well.
Now, within the LaPorte District, since you know well how the planning is going, and you've kind of talked about the fact that there may be some more work that will be done on I-65 south of the Kankakee River bridges, what kind of ideas are in the thoughts of the engineers and other people there at the LaPorte District offices as to how this project can be expanded further south? I guess getting closer and closer yet to the next area that's already been improved.
Sure. That's always a desire. I mean, from NDOT, but from various levels of state government, I think everybody agrees that I-65 could use an added travel lane much farther south. And that's a desire. As of right now, though, it comes ultimately down to funding for the project. So, they're looking at opportunities for that. That's a desire. But as of right now, nothing is set in the works from a planning standpoint.
I know that obviously people that travel down to Indianapolis, they get to see the improvements have already been made. The latest improvements, of course, there around the Lafayette area. And then when you go further south to get down by Lebanon, you see it's almost like six lanes through the area there. And that's an area that obviously has grown very much in economic development, I guess, in part because of the fact that I-65 is wider and it's much more able to handle the traffic. Do you just at least think that with this expansion, just the additional travel lanes going to help out in making it easier to bring more businesses and industries into our part of the state?
Well, that's always the desire. Obviously, safety and mobility is our number one goal, but economic development obviously would be something that we would love to see a benefit to. I can't speak to whether that's going to happen for sure or not, but I can say, the alleviating congestion and the safety aspect is definitely going to be improved due to these added travel lanes, and oftentimes that does come with it. So we sure hope that is a reflex from this added travel lane.
And we know that, for example, there at just off 231 there in Crown Point, there's a big development project, industrial and commercial, that's being planned, and a lot of that I know is going to depend on how well the US 231 can handle the traffic and how traffic can get on and off I-65 there too. So there are all kinds of people that are wanting to find out more about whether this is going to really be of benefit to Northwest Indiana.
Sure, and I don't see any situation where this would be a negative factor, obviously, because the congestion is always an issue. If you drive that, I drive that road frequently, and there's always a challenge with congestion, especially if you get up to US 30. So obviously this is going to be a benefit. How far reaching that benefit will be, we'll have to wait to see, but I'm just very pleased that from a safety and mobility standpoint, we're definitely going to see some definite upside.
Now, Matt, I know we've been spending time talking today about the I-65 Northwest Indiana expansion project, but we know that this is getting into the construction season very close as the weather warms up here. Are there any other highways here in Northwest Indiana that we should be probably aware that there are going to be some major projects on that are in the works or will be in the next 4 or 5 months or so?
Sure. This is construction season. As everybody can see, the barrels will be popping up soon, not just I-65, but like you mentioned, all throughout the area. There's lots of construction projects popping up. It's just getting to be that time where we're starting to hold those meetings before the construction begins. So, in the next 2 months or so is when you'll see a lot of those construction projects opening up. Coming up next week, we actually have some bridge projects up in the Highland area and the Hammond area, and you can find those on our Facebook page as well. But there's projects all throughout the area. With a 13-county district, there's a lot to discuss, but yeah. You can always find lots of information on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/NDOTNorthwest. And there's also our website has an 18-month letting list. If you search the NDOT 18-month letting list, just go pop that into Google, You'll be able to find projects from wherever area you want to. If you want to look at a specific county and see what kind of development is happening in that area. And you can always contact NDOT with any questions you might have as well.
Well, I know that we've all seen some work that has been done, and I guess is continuing on 8094, the Borman Expressway, and and that's had some benefit of some work here in the last few years. And everybody was always wondering, well, that's even more congested than I-65, sure, as we know. And if there's going to be any problems, they'll have to be taken care of on 8094 in the months ahead.
Yeah, you know, 894 also is over capacity, and obviously we would love to do more on that. Unfortunately, there's not a lot much space to add any travel lanes there. We're looking at options, though, from a congestion standpoint. That said, on the plus side, you know, the last 2 years have been pretty challenging on 894, as everyone knows, with construction. We had a pretty big blitz, a two-year blitz, what we called Restore 94, where there was a lot of different types of projects throughout that area. Fortunately, this year, significantly reduced construction. Part of the reason why we were able to do that was that two-year blitz was so that these future years will not have as much of an impact from a construction standpoint. There's still going to be construction. There's, you know, bridge painting and things we have to do. You know, and I understand folks obviously get frustrated when they see I-65 or 894 under constant construction. But, you know, these are heavily, heavily traveled roads, some of the most heavily traveled roads in the country,
yeah,
and, you know, being the crossroads of America. So, you know, that means they have to have a lot of work done, everything from minor little pipe issues to major resurfacing. So, you know, we're doing the best we can, and we try to move traffic well, but we just ask folks patience, and things will be much better. But 894 will be in better shape from a construction standpoint this year, definitely.
And obviously you can keep track of this particular project, the expansion of I-65 here in Lake into Newton counties, by going on to NDOT's website. There's a specific page just for that, and you can always keep up on the information too, and we'll bring you updates as we get it in. So, but for now, just remember that there will be overnight periods in our area, and especially in South Lake County, where that you're going to find some kind of restrictions, and maybe even, I guess, some full lane closures, I guess, while the crews are out there working.
That's correct. And the thing I would like to stress the most to folks is just be alert of that construction out there. The last thing we want to see happen is accidents. And the biggest challenge with projects like this is that end-of-queue accidents where, you know, traffic is slowed or backed up and people aren't paying attention and they're hitting the back of the line. So
yeah,
we really stress to folks this season, especially on I-65, but throughout, be alert, be aware, and that way you can be safe out there. And our driver and our workers, that is, can be safe as well.
Matt Deichley is spokesperson for NDOT's LaPorte District, and telling us about the I-65 Northwest Indiana expansion project. Matt, thanks for the info, and if we have questions, we'll be back in touch and hope to have you back again and talk about some more projects in the future.
You bet. Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's the host of Green Fleet Radio, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guests are Ms. Danette Garza, CEO and owner of Jack Gray Transport and Lakes and Rivers Logistics, and Mr. Jim Dillman, COO of Jack Gray Transport and Lakes and Rivers Logistics. Thank you, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, first of all, congratulations, Danette, on being named the 2017 South Shore Clean Cities Empowering Woman of the Year at our annual meeting in February.
Well, thank you so much, Carl. I appreciate that that warm reception. I was really honored to receive that award and quite surprised by it, but it meant a lot to me, so thank you again.
You're welcome. Very well deserving. Tell our listeners a little bit about Jack Gray Transport and Lakes and Rivers and Logistics. What do the companies actually do?
Well, first of all, Jack Gray Transport was established in 1951 by its founder, Jack Gray. Jack Gray Transport basically is a trucking company that hauls bulk commodities. So everything is handled by it's all dumper hauling. Lakes and Rivers Logistics is basically our new port location that's located at Buffington Harbor in the city of Gary.
And so I know, Danette, you had a great story about how you came to acquire Jack Gray Transport and your relationship with Jack Gray. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. I met Mr. Gray in the 1990s through some mutual friends, and we ended up becoming friends. And in mid, probably about 2005, he asked that I represent him as an attorney. I'm an attorney and a CPA, and so I handled Mr. Gray's estate planning work and then started handling his business work as well. So he had retained me to handle the due diligence in preparation for the sale of his business, and that's how I got involved with the sale. Unfortunately, the financing for the prospective buyer had fallen through, and so that's how I ended up having the opportunity to buy it. So I recused myself as his attorney and was able to submit my bid on it. Once he became ill, I did take over as a consultant at that point to manage things until until his death in 2015.
I know there's a lot of exciting things that you're doing at Jack Gray. Can you tell our listeners a little bit of how you've modernized Jack Gray Transport and Lakes and Rivers logistics?
Yes, definitely. We did three major things. First of all, one of the things I recognized was that the accounting system was somewhat antiquated. We handle about 72,000 loads a year. And so handling that type of volume in a fashion that is not modernized takes a lot of time. So the first thing we did was purchase the software for Axon. It's one of the state-of-the-art software programs for trucking. And we started that in 2016, so that was a huge task to change the processes over to that. Secondly, we've utilized Fleetmatix, which is one of the other primary software companies for electronic records mm-hmm. that is used to track the trucking and some of the routing for our trucks. And finally, the prime thing that you mentioned is we recently purchased six new vehicles that that provide a reduction of emissions to the extent of about 97%.
That's wonderful. And congratulations. And I know, Jim, you're new to the companies but have a long history in the stevedoring industry. What are some of the trends you're seeing in the industry, and what are some of the plans for Jack Gray Transport and Lakes and Rivers Logistics?
Well, thanks, Carl. Yeah, it's great being a part of Jack Gray again mm-hmm. and coming back up here into the Northwest Indiana area. It's really coming home for me. And, you know, what we see in the industry, especially actually throughout the United States, is that the United States is really becoming a raw materials provider much more than a finished products provider. Mm-hmm. And so that really fits into our strategic plan of Jack Gray to be able to handle more of these bulk materials and vertically integrate the company as much as we possibly can and truly become a full logistics provider for all of our customers.
So I know both of your companies are members of South Shore Clean Cities and recently acquired these new biofueled trucks through the IDEM diesel grant. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that project?
Yeah, that was really working directly with South Shore Clean Cities and with the state. We recognized the need at Jack Gray to modernize the fleet, as Danette mentioned. And really working with that, and we understood it helps the environment a great deal. It helps the city, and being able to do this provides a lot of our workers and our customers a much more efficient method and purpose for our vehicles.
Mm-hmm. As you talk about the future, can you maybe just elaborate a little bit on some of the things that you're looking at doing with both companies on a more sustainable types of activities as you grow here in northern Indiana?
Right. What we see is that that throughout here in Gary Port, we really want to fulfill the mayor's vision of developing Buffington Harbor as a true port here in Northwest Indiana, and being able to offer that alternative to the customers that we have. And with Jack Gray, we're able to provide both the trucking services and the materials services both down at the port to be able to vertically integrate that as much as we can.
So how can people learn more about Jack Gray Transport and Lakes and Rivers Logistics?
To reach us at Jack Gray, probably the simplest way is to look at jackgray.com, our mm-hmm. website. And then Lakes and Rivers Logistics, the phone number is area code 833-GARY-PORT. And so those are the two primary ways of contacting us.
Any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our program today of some of the things that you are looking forward to the future for northern Indiana here?
Well, I think that, you know, by utilizing the DieselWise grants here, I think that people need to understand that there's the risk reward is definitely there. And I think that, you know, we feel proud of being able to utilize the DieselWise grant and being able to provide a better community, better air for the vision or for the citizens of the community. And that it's something that, you know, there's no risk there. I mean, right. The reward is definitely there. We're saving 20,000 gallons a year. We've reduced our NOx emissions by almost 97%. And it's just something that by being able to modernize our fleet, we are a more productive fleet. And it's just something that I think that all businesses in the area need to look at.
We're really excited about your success so far and the future success of both companies. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Danette Garza, CEO and owner of Jack Ray Transport and Lakes and Rivers Logistics, and Mr. Jim Tillman of Jack Ray Transport and Lakes and Rivers Logistics. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, and the podcast of this program and others are available on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Improving government is the subject of this Lakeshore Focus on Lakeshore PBS with Keith Kirkpatrick, and here's the conversation.
Most of us would agree that our governing process in America is broken, or at least does not work very well. A group of community leaders and concerned citizens gathered to have a conversation about this subject. Here to report on what they saw and heard are two of the participants from that event. With fresh perspectives, we have Elizabeth Clements and Jim Jessup. Now, I usually give these big titles of what you guys do, but really, you're here because you are engaged citizens. But people might want to know a little bit about your background. You're now a student, Elizabeth, right?
Yes.
So you've just kind of gone back to school?
Yes.
As a non-traditional student?
Yes.
What were you doing before that?
I was a restaurant manager for McDonald's.
Okay, and you did that for really quite a few years.
Actually, I've worked for McDonald's since my teenage years.
Okay, yeah. You act like that was way back or something.
Yeah, it was.
You look young enough that it wasn't
great.
That long ago.
Thank you.
Jim, on the other hand, has done a lot of things. Gosh, Jim, real quick, school teacher. What else have you done?
Yeah, I spent about 20 years of my life in the education field, about 20 years of my life doing a business, a State Farm insurance agent, retired about 12 years ago now, and have always been an active volunteer in the community trying to make things better.
You're definitely in the category of somebody who's really engaged in the community and a community leader. I see that. I know that about you.
We've worked together many years.
We have. So Elizabeth, you're kind of a little new to this game, mm-hmm. kind of jumping in to what's your interest in? Why are you so interested in government and governance and elections and those kind of things?
Well, I've always been interested. I've always voted. I've always felt that it was my duty. But since going back to school, I am majoring in psychology, but I've been looking more at the psychology that's applied in politics and the way that voters have a perception of the candidate and why do we vote for the people that we vote for and what are the values that really, you know, stick to people and what do they want to see.
So you're taking all the psychology classes like, and, you know, unusual behavior,
yes.
and dysfunctional minds and all that kind of stuff, because that kind of ties to politics, don't you think?
Yeah, it really does, you know, especially in this day and age and, you know, the different things that we're seeing and with social media being out there and, you know, the way that candidates are able to represent themselves and is that a turnoff? Is it a turn on? You know, are you getting the votes? Are you, you know, really articulating your ideas?
There is a lot of psychology to it.
Yeah, there really,
there really is. I don't know if I've ever asked you this question before, but what keeps you, why have you engaged yourself so deeply into the community, into leadership roles, and helping teach leaders to be good leaders?
Yeah, I've always kind of gone toward that leadership kind of thing. I like to watch the whole leadership play out. I'm not an active participant politically in any way, but I've just enjoyed watching good and bad leadership. And I think so much, every community needs so many really good leaders, decision makers, and it's fun for me to work with those people and try to offer suggestions on how community leaders can get better and improve their community. So it's all about leadership and community for me.
Well, I disagree with the fact that you said you're really not involved in an active role, because there's people who are out, you're just not always out front, but you are definitely behind the scenes.
I want to stay there, quite frankly, yes.
Well, we need a lot of people behind the scenes,
sure.
and doing
Absolutely.
Things and helping guide people. So I asked both of you on the show because you were at this specific event. And so when I talked to Jim on the phone, I said, find somebody who's an active participant. And I said, you guys are really going to come here like you're mini reporters. You were there, and I want our audience to know what happened, because this seemed like a pretty significant event. Jim, can you, like, just, what was this event?
It was precipitated certainly by just low voter turnout in LaPorte County historically, and that's true of every county, of course, but specifically in LaPorte County, and then just not a lot of engagement from young people and older people in the whole process, political process, and the voting process. So we said, well, let's put a forum together and bring in seasoned people in the community, and then let's show a lot of young faces too. We wanted young faces in this forum, and so we invited high school students from all over the county and our PNW, Purdue friends also, to come and sit down as panelists and discuss the issues, and specifically, what can we do about it then, of course? When we got done discussing, we said, let's do something, and what suggestion do you have about improving the voter process, improving the electoral process, the political process in LaPorte County? And we very specifically kept it local in focus.
And I want our viewers to know this conversation is not just about LaPorte County, because I think, in fact, one of the reasons I wanted you on this show was to talk about this issue everywhere. Voter turnout is low everywhere. Engagement in the community is low everywhere.
It is.
We got some real problems in our communities. So you ask Elizabeth, so why do you think he asked you to be part of this?
I don't know. Maybe just interest.
She doesn't know that.
Quite yeah.
Frankly. Again, we really wanted to reach out to young people. And so we went to the high schools and asked, you know, high schoolers to come. But then, of course, we have the Purdue right in our backyard there. And so we wanted them to, we reached out to some of the staff and professors at Purdue and asked them to make some suggestions of students who might be interested in attending the forum and then also participating. And we had I had three or four students contact me, and I just looked through their resumes and kind of randomly picked Elizabeth as the one to do that. I didn't know her, I had never met her, but just from things she said, I think she would have been a good participant, and she was. She did amazing things. So
having heard that explanation, how do you feel about the fact that you were picked to be part of this panel and be part of the speakers at the event?
It makes me feel special. It makes me feel like maybe I do have some good ideas roaming around up here. And
you realize Jim's really big on like trying to find people to run for office.
Yes.
And things like that, right? So he's kind of one of those, again, behind the scenes of pokes people.
I do have to say that Elizabeth did an amazing thing after she was chosen for this. She went on a Facebook page, a LaPorte Facebook page, and posted some really good questions. Questions that she said, we're going to be asked as a panelist, you know, what would you provide as feedback? It sounds dangerous, right, to open something up like that on Facebook. But she got amazing comments, over 100 comments back, almost all of them great comments, positive comments, and she did a great job of moderating the discussion on Facebook.
Wow. Well, tell us about what kind of response you got.
Well, I basically just asked some real generalized questions. Do you vote? Do you not vote? If so, why not? What do you feel would be important to become, you know, a more informed voter? Because I think that's a big issue. Would you ever, you know, run for an elected position? What do you value? You know, just real generalized questions about politics, not necessarily, you know, party lines or anything like that. And we got about 150 comments, and there was no fighting. There was no party this or party that.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. It really was.
It was very positive input and feedback that we were seeking, of course, in the forum, but she got this all prior to the forum.
Yeah. So it gave you some ammunition to
Yes, that's what I was looking for.
Were most of the people you reached out to or responded, were they younger?
I had all over the place. One person who I actually went to school with, she had responded, and she's about 20 or so, and then I had, you know, senior citizens responding, 70 to 75, you know, with their experience, what it's been like voting, you know, throughout the years, what they've seen change.
Why'd you do this?
Well, personally, I was just looking for insight for the panel. Like, I wanted to, you know, come in informed and maybe have just some general ideas from LaPorte County residents and what they wanted to see happen, since we were kind of focusing on a local level.
So let's give our viewers a little bit. There was a panel of younger people in the morning, and I love your term, the seasoned people in the afternoon. Are these in their fall or winter season?
This actually was a Saturday morning in January, and we got eight high school students on the panel Saturday morning, 8:30 in January came out, and it was all morning session. Again, with high school and younger students on the first panel, and then somewhat older students, although we had a couple of millennials on that adult panel, too.
So this is all about trying to find out where people kind of stand mm-hmm. with the political process and how they view it and why people are so standoffish and mm-hmm. why they're not engaged, why everybody complains about everything. So what was your biggest takeaway from the panel in the morning?
The students want to be engaged. I walked away with just the overwhelming sense that the kids wanted to know more about what is happening in our local government. They talked about their government classes mostly focusing on federal and state level, but they never really break it down to the local level. And so a couple of them had wanted the officials to actually come to their school and explain to them what they do, you know, how to run for an elected position, you know, the different aspects of government. And then the more seasoned panel had come back with, well, maybe we could do shadow days where, you know, we come, we tell you about our job, and then maybe some students come with us to, you know, the courthouse.
So there's some practical mm-hmm. ideas. You know, as you talk about the younger people being engaged, and I think historically we've always seen that. Mm-hmm. Did anybody talk during the panel, or maybe it was with the more seasoned panel, why people at some point lose that interest or start backing off? Because here you have high school students who are going, yeah, we want to be engaged, mm-hmm. but we know now the voter turnout, when it comes to time to be engaged and vote, it drops way off. Was there discussion any time during the day about what's going on?
There were many, many reasons given, and they kind of fell into certain categories. One of them, very simply, the whole mud of the mm-hmm. political thing, the national right now, of course, turns people off for sure. They have a real problem voting in the primary elections that are closed primaries. In other words, you must go choose. Mm-hmm. They're open primaries, literally, meaning you have to choose a political party in the primary. Lots of comments that they don't like that at all. The communication is not good. How do you communicate? I saw people say, I just forget on election day to go and vote. Now, to me, that just seems impossible with all of the stuff that goes
on. So what
do
they mean by the communication is not good? What are they saying?
People communicate in so many different ways now. Obviously, the younger people want to communicate on social media mainly. The older people don't. Mm-hmm. People don't read newspapers anymore. The whole communication about community, I think, slips past a lot of people these days because we don't communicate in the same way like we used to, certainly.
What did you hear, Elizabeth, in terms of why you think younger people, or what's your theory? Why do people start off in their teens and so forth? Many of them want to run for office, but mm-hmm. by the time they turn 25 or 30, they're like, forget this.
You know, I really agree with what Jim had said. There was a lot of talk about running their names through the mud, you know. They just didn't want to listen to all the negativity. They wanted to hear more positive things that were going on.
Or be subjected to it, right?
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. So
there are a lot of technical issues, too, that are involved. People said should open the polls longer. Mm-hmm. Go to voting centers mm-hmm. so we know where we can go and vote every time, the same place kind
really,
of thing.
Really want to change how we're doing things.
A lot of system changes, right. Same-day registration was a big deal that actually is in the legislature right now. It's not going to happen this year, but that's a big deal. As I mentioned, the primary thing, ballot, vote by ballot, or vote by mail, that's becoming a huge thing across the country, and a lot of states are having a lot of success voting by mail. So there are lots of system things that affect people also.
Right. So let me ask you this, and I'll ask you now from your perspective. You were watching the seasoned group. So what was your takeaway from the older group, what they were saying?
That they didn't really realize that the younger generation wanted to be engaged. They just thought that, you know, they were like, it's voting, it's not a big deal, you know. And they really kind of took to the idea of going to the local schools and, you know, talking about what they do and getting the youth to, you know, engage with them.
So. Was it noticeable with the millennials versus the more season? The millennials, I guess, are more in their summer of their seasons, right?
There we go. I guess maybe that's what it
is. Because we won't say who was in the winter of their season.
Right, yeah, but, don't go there.
Did you notice a difference in what was said by the younger adults versus the older adults? Is there any difference?
I think the biggest difference that I've seen was the social media comments. You know, one youth panelist had made the comment, this past election was won on Twitter. And the seasoned people that were there were like, no, you know, they really don't like the negativity that usually comes with social media. If they post, you know, we're looking at doing this, they don't want to read through all the negative comments about, you know, character or whatnot. Whereas the youthful generation was like, well, that's how we see the news. You know, we don't sit down and watch the TV.
And that leads, of course, to the political parties and the candidates having to change their methods of getting the word out, for sure. Which we did have political parties there. We had a lot of candidates and elected officials in the room. And their eyes, I think, were opened a lot by hearing this thought, we've got to change how we're getting the word out. We've got to change how we communicate with the public out there. I think that was a big takeaway from a lot of the older adults in the room and the candidates and the parties too.
So it's interesting. There's a lot of comments about communication, yet when there is communication that works, it's kind of negative and not real functional. So
I think a lot of that comes again much more from the national scene that people associate that just in general political politics and elections that people immediately think of a negative kind of thing. We heard my vote doesn't count. Heard a lot of that, really, that they really think that they go and vote, but it doesn't count, doesn't make a difference.
Which is really interesting because you would think that argument makes sense at a national level.
Right.
But at a local level, when you see somebody wins 322 to, you know, 319, right. It's like, those votes do count. There's only 600 people voting.
Well, there was one comment on that is the schools aren't teaching how the local government functions. So the children are walking away with everything functions on a national level. So they don't realize the Electoral College doesn't have anything to do with our local elections. So one vote is one vote. And like you said, you know, it might be a margin of two or three votes.
So that's really interesting. Yeah. So the students were saying that they just really don't know how local government functions?
Right.
They apparently, from what they said, and it was pretty clear, the local schools do not teach local government, that local level kind of government. Townships and county government apparently is not taught in the schools. And we heard that loud and clear. So we've started to form a committee already. In fact, one of the elected officials after the meeting came up to me and said, I will volunteer to chair that group. We're going to reach out to the schools and see if we can get forums, training, something into the schools to talk about local politics, local elections, and also about how we get these kids engaged, because they were begging for engagement. They were begging for that.
So there really wasn't an expectation to have tangible outcomes to this. It was really meant to be really a start, a conversation.
We wanted people, and at the end of the session, we said, okay, who's going to make a commitment here now? We want a commitment from you. And we wrote down, a lot of people just, stood up and said, gave really ideas, commitments of what they're going to do. And we walked out of there. In fact, I just this morning compiled a list. I think I ended up with about 40 ideas, things that we need to work on locally.
So there was one concrete one you just shared. Did you hear any other concrete like themes that were like everybody seemed to kind of want to do something?
Really just the education of it and the communication of where to find the information about forums or candidates and, you know, things like that. I think those were really the two main issues we walked away with.
How has this changed you, both of you, how has this changed your perception of things and kind of how you see your role, particularly you, the younger person, not to take away from Jim's junior, right?
Well, as far as my perception, you know, in government class, at least, you know, we're always taught that the 18 to 25 demographic just doesn't mm-hmm. vote. They just don't vote. And so this was really eye-opening to hear these kids that are in that demographic talking about, we want to vote, we want to understand, please.
But how did it change you personally? So that made you aware, but what are you going to do different?
I don't know. I just really want to become involved on a political level. I want to be able to, you know, help people register to vote. I want to be able to find a way to fix that communication gap. I think that's something that I've been thinking about a lot, is how do we get this information to everyone on a level that everybody can get to.
You have a motivation and an idea. We might have to do a follow-up show and see what she's done in 6 months or 1 year. Has this changed your perception of anything, Jim, or how you're going to do something differently?
I've been working with kids and with these issues for years, and I've always said our youth is a resource that we ignore mm-hmm. in our communities way too much. I saw this group of people in this room come to realize that same thing as they were sitting there. I've known it for a long time. We need to find ways to reach out to these kids and engage them in the community. I've always been a proponent of creating a culture of youth advisory councils within a community at all levels, government, nonprofit, business. Service organizations, every one of them needs a youth advisory council.
Okay.
And I've been saying that for years, and I saw other people kind of say, wow, I think that could work.
Well, I'd like to encourage our viewers to consider that even though this was done in LaPorte County, this could be done in any county, mm-hmm. in a portion, in a community, any place to have this dialogue and start this conversation, because we do need to fix this mm-hmm. problem and get people more engaged, and particularly not lose our young people who are interested, right. but then lose interest. So thank you both for coming and sharing what you saw and heard, and for your participation in the community. I really appreciate both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Friday nights at 7:30, and it's rebroadcast Sunday mornings at 9:30 on Lakeshore PBS.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. The United States is facing an unprecedented threat from opioid addiction. Opioids are not only addictive, they are incredibly dangerous. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the amount of deaths from drugs that contain opiates, certain prescription painkillers, heroin, and fentanyl, is 5 times what it was in 1999. And out of all the deaths from drug overdoses in the entire country, 66% involve an opiate. Tragically, Indiana is one of the states faring worse than the national average. According to the Indiana State Health Department, deaths from drug overdoses involving opiates is 6 times what it was in 1999. An adult Hoosier is more likely to die of a drug overdose than a car accident. And addiction in Indiana has damaged families and communities and caused other illnesses like HIV to spread due to intravenous drug use. Overdoses in Indiana alone cost $1 billion a year in healthcare. Although this epidemic may seem insurmountable, there are Hoosiers who are employing strategies that merge STEM and the humanities to tackle the growing opioid problem. In fact, the Indiana University President Michael Robbie and Governor Eric Holcomb announced an innovative approach to deal with the crisis in October of 2017. They announced a $50 million initiative that would be donated by Indiana University. This initiative will be one of the largest and most unique state programs to tackle the opioid crisis, and the largest university-led initiative in the country. The initiative partners IU with the governor, government agencies, IU Health, Ashkenazi Health, and with more continuing to sign on. This program is masterminded by the principal investigator, Dean Robin Newhouse of the Indiana University Nursing School, and is focused on attacking the epidemic from every angle and utilizing the combined knowledge of the entire university. Robin is one of the most celebrated nurses in the country. She was inducted into the Nursing Researcher Hall of Fame in 2014 and is the woman in charge of Indiana's fight against addiction. Though in the past, drug addiction has been seen primarily as a moral flaw, treated with talk therapy, we now know much more about the disease of addiction. But we don't know everything, which is why Robin is starting off this huge initiative with 16 initial projects ready to go to learn new things about addiction from many different points of view, from public health, economic, mental health, criminal justice, and scientific thought. Robin is a believer in combining STEM and the humanities to tackle complex problems like addiction. Therefore, Robin has introduced new programs to cover 5 different areas: ground-level data collection and analysis, training and education, policy analysis and development, addiction science, and community and workforce development. Today, we are going to take a closer look at 3 of the most innovative projects that Robin has chosen to showcase how STEM and humanities can be combined to solve huge societal problems. They are a medical research project, a big data project, and a health policy project. The innovative research project is led by Dr. Teresa Bell from the IU School of Medicine. She is a surgery expert and has performed groundbreaking research with doctors and researchers at IU Medical School who are researching a currently unverified idea of addiction. A large number of opioid addictions begin with receiving painkillers from a medical professional for an illness like back pain or a broken arm. Teresa is looking into whether children who take painkillers for sports-related injuries as a child are at a higher likelihood of developing an opioid addiction versus children who do not experience a traumatic injury. Her results will help doctors carefully weigh the costs and benefits of giving a child opioid painkillers and could lead to tighter restrictions on painkillers in the future. Restricting the amount of opioid painkillers in circulation is central to IU's objective to, as they put it, curb the flow of opioids in Indiana. The Big Data Project is being led by Peter Emby from the Regent Streiff Institute. Its goal is to streamline the information that healthcare providers, law enforcement, and public health researchers have access to. Ordinarily, these groups have access to vastly different kinds of information because of the different ways that they interact with those with addiction. This innovative data-driven project will collect data about those suffering from addiction from each of these different sectors and share them. This will hopefully help identify those with substance abuse disorders earlier and prevent death by overdose. Public health experts could use the data to find common traits of substance abuse, which can give us tools to stop it. Sharing data in this way is a popular trend in humanities fields right now, because it allows researchers from every discipline to have access to data that will improve the depth and accuracy of their research. The final initiative we'll look at today is a humanities approach led by Ross Silverman, an expert in health policy and law, and legal expert Nicholas Terry. They aim to explore what laws and policies can be passed in order to improve the health outcomes for those with substance abuse disorder. This is an innovative approach worth mentioning, because often policy and law are not necessarily focused on the well-being of the addicted person as much as the safety of the community as a whole. This exciting research will hopefully determine evidence-based law and policy that could be passed in Indiana to help save lives of those addicted to opioids. Dean Robin Newhouse may be a new Hoosier, but she is already making Hoosier history as the leader of this important and unprecedented movement that combines humanities and science, technology, engineering, and math to solve the problem of addiction. We are lucky to have her and all of her colleagues leading the way as we confront this crisis head on. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
That's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll have, among others, Giles Bruce and Carmen McCollum, both reporters for The Times of Northwest Indiana. Hope you can join us.